From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Happy Holiday. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a concert of jazz and pop standards with singer Susanna McCorkle. Stereo Review calls McCorkle the finest interpreter of sophisticated songs. When you hear her, you'll understand why. Also on today's show, I talk with film sound designer Alan Splett. It was his job to intensify the creepy edge in films like Blue Velvet and Eraserhead with his bizarre, otherworldly sounds. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Brian Ferry, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, the new film from the director and screenwriter who collaborated on My Beautiful Laundrette. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is singer Susanna McCorkle, who is one of today's most gifted interpreters of American popular song. You'll be able to hear for yourself in a moment when she performs live in our studio. Jazz critic Leonard Feather named Susanna McCorkle Singer of the Year last December and wrote that her tone, phrasing, and sensitivity match her taste in songs. Stereo Review gave one of her recent albums a Record of the Year award. Her recordings have paid tribute to songwriters like Harry Warren, Johnny Mercer, Yip Harburg, and Leo Robin, and have also featured songs by contemporaries like Dave Frischberg and Rupert Holmes. Her new album is called Dream. Susanna McCorkle is also a short story writer who has received an O. Henry Award and has been published in several magazines, and she's a translator and interpreter of four languages. Playing with her today is Ben Aronov on piano and Chip Jackson on bass. I want to welcome all of you to Fresh Air. And Susanna, before we talk about your music, would you sing a couple of songs for us?
I'd love to. The first one I want to do is my little tribute to Fred Astaire, a wonderful singer people think of as a dancer, but all those of us in music treasure his records, and songwriters loved writing for him because he was just a guy singing. He didn't impose himself on the song. He really gave a lot of attention to the lyrics and the music. So this is for Fred.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits. Putting on the Ritz. Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Super duper, come let's go where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts. Putting on the Ritz. Go where fashion sits, putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits, putting on the Ritz. That's where each and every Lulu Bell goes. Every Thursday evening with a swell bows, rubbing elbows, come let's go and we'll attend a jubilee and we can spend our last two bits putting on the Ritz.
One of my favorite lyricists is Yip Harburg, who tried to put his humanist politics into his songs and the shows that he wrote for. And I had the pleasure of meeting him when I was making a tribute album to him. I found out he lived right around the corner from me in Manhattan. I was terrified of meeting him. I'm always scared of meeting all the songwriters. And he was a bit forbidding because he was really worried that nobody young would understand his songs and what they were about and if they were supposed to be funny. But once he saw that I really knew a lot about his songs and extra lyrics and obscure songs, he opened right up. He was really wonderful and showed me a lot of unusual music. He did his own show toward the end of his life, and he always used to sing "If I Only Had a Brain" from The Wizard of Oz. I took another verse from The Wizard from that same song that was sung by the Cowardly Lion and the Tin Woodsman and the Scarecrow, "If I Only Had a Heart," and I was fascinated when he said that when he and Harold Arlen wrote the score for Over the Rainbow, they really tried not to talk down to children. They did adult songs. They didn't think of kiddie songs. And maybe that's why the songs have lasted so well, because this one seems really almost a song with an 80s sensibility. It seems to me that it could be a song about just being in touch with your feelings. Empty kettle, she should be on her mettle, and yet I'm torn apart. Just because I'm presuming that I could be kinda human if I only had a heart, I'd be tender, I'd be gentle, an awful sentimental regarding love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy that shoots the arrows if I only had a heart. Picture me a balcony above, a voice sings low, "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?" I hear a beat. How sweet, just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I would stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart. If I only had a heart.
That's beautiful. Susanna, you have just a magnificent voice. And I'd like to take a few
minutes. Actually, so do
you, Terry. Let's take out a few minutes to talk before you sing some more songs. And, you know, I've been listening to your records for years, but I know very little about you, so I really want to find out some more. When did you start singing popular songs?
Well, I grew up always really loving songs. I used to listen to them on the radio, and my mother had a lot of Broadway show albums in the days when the music was just sensational, My Fair Lady and West Side Story and things, mid-50s and earlier South Pacific and Finian's Rainbow. So I always was fascinated by the stories in songs. I used to lie on the floor listening to them and figuring out who was singing them, why they were unhappy or what was, or happy. And I went through the 60s, like everybody, trashing all that and thinking it was stupid and establishment and boring. And it wasn't really until I went to Europe as a disenchanted youth in the mid-60s and late-60s that I rediscovered, or really discovered for the first time, the richness of American popular culture, especially of the 30s and 40s, in movies, movie musicals like Fred and Ginger, Busby Berkeley, and dramatic movies like Double Indemnity and Sunset Boulevard. That was all new to me. And also old jazz records from the 30s, Duke Ellington and earlier Billie Holiday with the small group records of the 30s, and earlier Bessie Smith. And I became really fascinated by them and thought that there was a whole country that I hadn't known about growing up, and it must still be there, at least in vestiges. And I just really wanted to get with people who appreciated those things.
What happened in Europe to show you this kind of music that you had ignored during a period in America?
Well, it was the music of the intelligentsia there, really. It was the snob appeal at first, because I spent time with students and artists around my age, and they really knew so much about Charlie Parker, you know, jazz, and Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday. And the records were readily available, even in the chain drugstores and supermarkets there. You could buy a Billie Holiday record for the equivalent of $2, and it was just more readily available. And that really got me interested. But I really only had to hear a Billie Holiday record once to know that she was something very special, and it was a tradition of singing that I felt deserved to be kept alive, very direct and honest, instead of either stagey and theatrical or folk music, which had a kind of innocence and guilelessness, but it wasn't really musically very sophisticated, or the Supremes, top 40 stuff. It just seemed a whole other way of singing and approaching music that I just loved. I was really ready to hear it, and it hit me like lightning.
After singing those kinds of songs in Europe, when you came back and when you were reunited with friends and family, were they really surprised at this new kind of material that you were doing?
Well, there wasn't really anybody to be reunited with. You know, I didn't have any friends from college, and I was living on the other side of the country from my parents. I just felt as if...
You changed your life then.
I did. I felt as if I didn't belong to anything. And then when I discovered jazz, I felt I belonged to jazz. It was like a tribe. And I was one of the strays who finally found my home tribe. And at first I lived in England. And I lived in London for a while. And I immediately felt that way. I had a shared sense of humor. And there were other things, different books that we liked, politics, movies, even foods. I felt, boy, these are my kind of people. And they were always here, but I just didn't know about them. And I still really feel that way, as if I'm a daughter of the tribe who has to pay my dues and go through certain things to be considered worthy of belonging to this tradition, you know. And I do love that feeling. I think Americans, at least WASPs like me, have a certain rootlessness. And that's, I found that popular music was my root, something good I could belong to and carry on.
I want to find out more about your singing and about how you started to sing, but why don't we save that for a little later in the program. Let me ask you to do another song, and I'll reintroduce you first. My guest is singer Susanna McCorkle. She's performing live for us today, and with her is Ben Aronoff on piano and Chip Jackson on bass.
We're going to do a famous George and Ira Gershwin standard. It's wonderful, it's marvelous. You should care for me. It's awful nice. It's paradise. It's what I long to see. You've made my life so glamorous. Don't blame me for being amorous. Oh, it's wonderful. It's marvelous that you should care for me. It's magnifique. What I seek, that you should care for me. It's elegant, it's what I want, it's what I long to see. My dear, it's four-leaf clover time. From now on, my heart's working overtime. Oh, it's wonderful, it's marvelous that should care for me, that you should care for me.
We're featuring a live concert today with singer Susanna McCorkle, Ben Aronoff on piano, Chip Jackson on bass. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with more performance and some more conversation with Susanna McCorkle. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
We have a concert today with singer Susanna McCorkle, pianist Ben Aronoff, and bassist Chip Jackson. Let me tell you a little bit about the pianist and bassist. Ben Aronoff has performed with Benny Goodman and the late Zoot Sims, and Chip Jackson plays with Tony Bennett, Liza Minnelli. He's recorded with Chuck Mangione. And Susanna McCorkle records now on the Pausa record label. Her new album is called Dream. Susanna, we'll talk some more in a few minutes. I'd really love for you to do another song first.
Okay, well, I know you have a very arty program with lots of literary figures. So I'd like to do a song that would never have been written if it hadn't been for one of the great literary figures, George Bernard Shaw. I'm sure even he would have approved of the way Lerner and Lowe interpreted one of his plays. I've grown accustomed to his face. He almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune. He whistles night and noon. His joys, his woes, his highs, his lows are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in, I was serenely independent and content before we met. Surely I could always be that way again, and yet I've grown accustomed to his looks, accustomed to his voice, accustomed to his face. I'm very glad he's just a man, and so easy to forget. Rather like a habit I could always break. And yet I've grown accustomed to that trace of something in the air, accustomed to his face.
Singer Susanna McCorkle, your singing and your phrasing are really both magnificent. Do you have any formal training or anything?
I don't have any. I just always grew up singing in school choirs, which I think was great, to always just be confident about opening your mouth and singing. And we used to sing in the car a lot. We used to sing rounds. But the one time I tried, I was living in Rome, and I thought I should learn about breathing and scales. And so I had a friend who studied classical singing, and I went to the teacher who taught her, who was named Maestro Ricci, and he had pictures of Anna Moffo kissing him, Joan Sutherland kissing him. I knew he was the wrong one, but he insisted that he could teach me, and he told me wear a surgical corset and hold, you know, it's whack my jaw, macella morbida, you know, he says keep your jaw relaxed, and I was so intimidated I couldn't even say I didn't really want to sing opera. And finally, after a few lessons, he said, I'm so sorry, really, you're a well-educated young lady, you speak good Italian, but you will never be a singer. You have a tiny, tiny thread of a voice. I'm so sorry to be the one to tell you this. And I was really so relieved. You know, I said, well, really, I didn't want to sing opera. I wanted to sing, you know, Gershwin. I tried to think of composers he'd identify, and he said, for this, you have enough of a voice already. You know, so that was really my only brush with vocal training. And I always do scales every day. I do 3 octaves of chromatic scales. And I try to keep in good shape, exercising, breathing. But as a jazz musician told me later in London, you know, if you just let go and make people feel song, nobody's going to worry about whether you read music or breathe right, you know. And many people have even said how good you didn't train, because I think there's so much emphasis on training that people tend to sound just alike. So, and my favorite singers just have a natural rough-edged sound. So even though sometimes I envy virtuosi who just have huge voices, I do notice sometimes you tune out of a voice like that. You just stop listening to the content in a way you would never do with Nat Cole or Billie Holiday or Ray Charles or somebody who's just more unique and kind of rough.
Well, your phrasing is also very personal. It also seems to come from your heart.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I never consciously think of phrasing. I think of lyrics and the person I am singing the song and just try to feel the song and not be too intellectual about it.
So you had this short-lived period of taking lessons, which was a disaster. But you liked to sing. You sang in the chorus. When did you actually start singing or think that you would be a professional singer?
Well, I did some summer stock in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They had shows, Bye Bye Birdie and Lil Abner. And I sang in those, and I liked singing, but I didn't like doing the same thing the same way every night. So for a while, I just didn't sing at all. I thought it had just been a school kid thing. And I was in a choral group at the University of California, but I hated it. It was 99 girls singing hymns and Rodgers and Hammerstein melodies. I said, what is this? So I just stopped singing. I didn't even have record player or anything. It was really Billie Holiday. I have to say, Billie Holiday made me want to be a singer.
So when you went to Europe, as you told us you did earlier, you didn't know you wanted to sing then?
No, I went as a writer. I'd already published a couple stories, and my parents had agreed they would give me just barely enough money to live on for a year and try to write. So that's why I was there.
As someone who would give anything to sing like you do, I can't imagine having such a voice and not thinking that you'd sing all the time.
Well, thank you. I guess I was pretty much an introverted person and solitary, and it is very hard. It's not hard for me anymore, but the thought of being yourself on stage and not hiding behind a role was very daunting, and I wasn't very good at it for a long time. You know, I used to stare down at my feet while I sang in London and everything, now it's the only way I know how to be. But I think in a lot of ways my personality type, I felt, wasn't suited to be a performer. I thought you had to be an extrovert. I don't think that's true anymore, but that's why I didn't really ever consider it.
Did you ever fear when you started gravitating toward popular song and toward some of the classic composers that maybe you'd missed your time?
I've always felt really glad to live in the time I lived in, because I was in a very interesting political time at Berkeley and a very good time for women. I would have been a starlet band singer if I'd been in the 40s, but I wouldn't get to be the woman that I am now, more independent, traveling and living alone in Europe. So I feel really good about it. I feel people said I was crazy to do that kind of music when I started in the early 70s, but that now people are ready to hear that. So I feel that I'm lucky that those records called out to me that way, and I wanted to heed the call.
And there isn't pressure now on women singers to be sex kittens or coy when they're on stage.
No, I think it's very different now. Communication is the thing, and just the way serious relationships are the thing. And I'm really glad to be singing now. I think I have a better chance to communicate and be a woman of the 80s, paying tribute and having learned from the past.
Could you do another song for us?
Well, sure. This is one of my favorites. I discovered it on a tape. People are always sending me these wonderful cassettes. This was of Johnny Mercer singing his own version of Hit the Road to Dreamland, a song he wrote in 1943 for a movie called Star Spangled Rhythm that featured Mary Martin and the Golden Gate Quartet. And it has not only the song he wrote with Harold Arlen, but also the patter section he wrote for the Golden Gate Quartet, who are dressed as porters, and was telling Mary Martin and her boyfriend they would have to get out of the club car of the railroad train.
Bye-bye, baby. Time to hit the road to dreamland. I'll dig you in the land of none. Hold tight, baby. We'll be swinging high in dreamland all night, baby, where little cherubs trod. Look at that knocked out moon, been a blowing his top in the blue. Never saw the likes of you. What an angel. Bye bye, baby. Time to hit the road to dreamland. Don't cry, baby. It was divine, but the rooster has finally crowed. Time to hit the road. Now, pardon me, ma'am, and pardon me, sir. This is not a job that we prefer, but it's strictly a railroad regulation that we close this car before we reach the station. So if you'll forgive my effrontery, I will be as brief as I can be. Yes, yes, good children, it's getting time to hit the road. With everything electric and mechanized, if you do get nervous, I ain't surprised. But you know, good people, you can't cure ills with capsule tablets or vitamin pills. The only thing to rest your head is a good night's sleep in a quilted bed. So just resolve to be good and firm, because the early bird is gonna catch the worm. Yes, yes, good children, it's getting time to hit the road. Now see that moon shining way up there. His chops is all beaten, he ain't nowhere. He's dying to get him some shut-eye too, but he's got to stay up and light the way for you. So be good children and treat him right, and he'll shine like a lantern tomorrow night. Now it's 2:30, and that ain't no crime. I trust you've had a most enjoyable time. I surely do thank you for your friendly call, but we're forced by law to say goodnight all. Bye-bye, baby, hit the road to dreamland. Don't cry, baby, it was divine, but the rooster has finally crowed. Time to hit the road. Time to hit the road. Time to hit the road. Time to hit the road.
That was really great. You know, I've wanted thank for so many years to hear you perform. It's really just a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Thank
for
you
for coming.
Terry.
And thanks to the musicians, Ben Aronoff on piano, Chip Jackson on bass, and Susanna McCorkle, who sang for us this afternoon. And thank you all so much for performing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. That was an encore presentation of a Fresh Air concert with Susanna McCorkle. If you'd like to hear more of her singing, her latest album is called Dream. I'm Terry Gross, and I wish you a happy holiday from all of us at Fresh Air. On our next show, an interview and performance with singer-songwriter and guitarist Loudon Wainwright. Here's a few bars from his latest album.
I can cook a little, but it's not a lot to shout about. It's kind of mean cuisine, so I eat out. Hey, they know me at the Greek and the Czech and the Italian, the Indian too. And they all say, here comes that sad American man again, what are we gonna do? Well, you can put me at the table in the corner in the back unless you got one in the telephone booth. I'm here and I'm alone again, it's sad, but it's the truth. No, I'm not expecting anyone, is that beyond belief? Give me the menu, take away the candle, never mind the aperitif. They got a couple of couples, a trio and a foursome, they even got a party of eight. I'm getting that look, I wish I'd brought a book, or better yet, I wish I'd already ate.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with film sound designer Alan Splett. He collaborated with David Lynch on Eraserhead and Blue Velvet and won an Academy Award for his sound work on The Black Stallion. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bette Noir, the new album by Brian Ferry, who co-founded Roxy Music. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. It was written by Hanif Qureshi and directed by Stephen Frears, the same team that made My Beautiful Laundrette. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. In a Thanksgiving holiday gesture, Attorney General Edwin Meese made telephone calls to family members of hostages being held by Cuban inmates at two federal prisons in Louisiana and Georgia. Meanwhile, 40 prisoners surrendered at the Atlanta Detention Center, and earlier today, Bureau of Prisons Director Michael Quinlan told reporters that negotiations are improving with detainees at the Oakdale, Louisiana facility.
The ability of the lead hostage negotiators to count on the return appearance of certain people at certain times indicates to us that there are improved lines of communication.
Federal officials say so far none of the 122 hostages being held at the two prisons has been harmed. The Chicago alderman who took over as acting mayor when Harold Washington died yesterday has taken himself out of contention as Washington's successor. David Orr held a news conference at Chicago City Hall today where he announced that a city council vote on Washington's replacement could come as early as next Tuesday. At least 200 people have died in a typhoon that swept across the Philippines this week. The BBC's Humphrey Hawksley has a report.
Details from the devastated areas are still sketchy, but the manager of a local Catholic radio station, Father Gerald de Mesa, said hundreds of people are still unaccounted for, and that bodies are being brought into the provincial capital for a memorial mass. The people are helpless, he said. They don't know where to turn, adding grimly that the authorities were running out of coffins. The area was hit by a tropical storm 3 months ago, but, said Father de Mesa, this one is far worse. Typhoon Nina swept into Sorsogon from the Pacific Ocean, creating huge waves which crashed into fishing settlements. The rickety shacks there, housing thousands of people, mainly fishing families, are said to have been destroyed. Large areas are still badly flooded. Appeals have been made for food, clothes, and medicine to cope with the aftermath of the typhoon. Electricity, communications, and transport in other parts of the central island of Luzon, including Manila, have been disrupted. Many schools, shops, and businesses are shut down.
Humphrey Hawksley in Manila. The long-awaited ceasefire proposal drawn up by the U.S.-backed Contras has finally arrived in Managua. A Vatican envoy from Costa Rica hand-carried the document to Cardinal Miguel Obando y Bravo, but the Contras have demanded the Cardinal not reveal its contents to the Sandinistas just yet. Details from Maureen Meehan.
Cardinal Obando y Bravo told reporters the Contras sent a request with the ceasefire proposal that he not disclose the contents of the document until the Cardinal had met personally with the Contras. The Contras also requested the Cardinal officially accept the position of mediator in the ceasefire talks before handing the proposal over to the Nicaraguan government. The Cardinal has agreed to both conditions and will travel next week to Costa Rica to meet with the Contra leadership. The Sandinista ceasefire proposal was made public in Washington 2 weeks ago by President Ortega. The Contras rejected that proposal. Without revealing the contents, Obando said he did not expect either side to accept the other's proposal at first sight. He said lots of discussion is going to be necessary and it probably won't be simple. For National Public Radio, I'm Maureen Meehan in Managua.
According to court documents, Teamsters President Jackie Presser has been providing information to the FBI for almost 14 years. The records were unsealed in U.S. District Court in Cleveland. They reveal the union boss has been an informant on the mafia's connections to some Teamsters officials and on how the mafia allegedly misused the union's Central States pension fund. The Cleveland Plain Dealer reported today that FBI documents show Presser has helped the FBI rid the union of organized crime since 1974. The economics minister of Greece resigned today. He said a move by President Papandreou has put his country's austerity program at risk. This is National Public Radio News. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from rock crooner Brian Ferry. Ferry co-founded Roxy Music with Brian Eno back in 1971. Ferry's new album is called Bette Noire.
Although he's never had much of an impact on American rock and roll, Brian Ferry is one of the most intriguing eccentrics the music has produced, and certainly its most elegant romantic. Ferry is an impressive self-made man. Born the son of a miner in northern England, Ferry studied art with the painter Richard Hamilton at Newcastle University. Like many young Englishmen in the wake of the Beatles, Ferry one day arrived at the increasingly common idea that making rock and roll was an artistic gesture as valid as, say, making a painting. Abandoning fine art for the more popular kind, Ferry began his musical career in the early 70s as the lead singer for Roxy Music. Surrounded by ringing guitars and shrill keyboards, Ferry sang about unrequited love in the tones of a bored aristocrat. Roxy Music recorded some of the driest, most reserved rock ever made, and Ferry, dressed in a black tuxedo or a white dinner jacket, became the band's focal point. Roxy Music became a huge hit in England, both for its sound and its fashion statements. Here's a bit from a Roxy Music song recorded in 1973, an arch parody of teen dance crazes called Do the Strand.
There's a new sensation, a fabulous creation, a danceable solution to teenage revolution. Do the strand, love, when you feel love. That's why we say, do the strand. Do it on the tables, Quackley's place or Mabel's. Slow and gentle, sentimental. All styles served here. Louis says he prefers.
The same year that song was released, 1973, Brian Ferry put out his first solo album, and it was an impeccable pop art gesture. The album, called These Foolish Things, consisted entirely of Ferry interpretations of well-known pop and rock songs, ranging from Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's a Gonna Fall to Smokey Robinson's The Tracks of My Tears. To each one, Ferry brought his groaning, so campy it's serious baritone, and the result was weirdly, improbably compelling. I mean, you haven't lived until you've heard Ferry moan through a little of Leslie Gore's It's My Party.
Julie and Johnny just walked through the door, but like a queen with her king. Oh, what a birthday surprise! Jude is wearing his ring. It's my party, and I'll cry if I want to. To you. Oh,
Ferry continued to alternate solo albums with Roxy Music Recordings until 1980, when the band broke up. Since then, he's released a series of frequently gorgeous albums under his own name, records that combine his early mock decadent style with an increasingly moving maturity that avoids any hint of irony or camp. Here's an example of that from the new album, Bête Noire, on a song called Limbo. Brian Ferry is one of the few rock stars who's grown into his style. Early in his career, he seemed like a young man yearning to be a decadent gigolo. Now in his 40s, he sings with a languid worldliness that no longer seems like a put-on. When he's bad, he still sounds stilted and foppish, but most of the time he's offering a romantic sort of rock music that is unique in its dreamy intensity.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Out of control, and as far as I can see, no religion will save me now. Though I'm trying to believe, how could I know a madness came?
This is Fresh Air. Alan Splett creates sounds for movies, frequently eerie sounds, sounds that not only establish the physical setting, but also create a psychological environment. Splett won an Academy Award for his work on Carol Ballard's film The Black Stallion. He also worked with Ballard on Never Cry Wolf. Splett was the sound designer for all of the films directed by David Lynch, from early shorts to Hollywood features, including Eraserhead, Elephant Man, Dune, and Blue Velvet. Alan Splett told me how he first met David Lynch back in 1969.
Well, I was working in Philadelphia. I was working at an industrial film house, which is no longer there now. And David had who lived nearby, and he had done a grant film for the American Film Institute, which was 35 minutes of 16-millimeter silent footage. He had no sound recording on it. And so he came to our company to have some sound put on the film. And by a quirk of fate, he wound up working with me. And we spent about, almost 3 months on the film. And we made all our sound effects for the film. We went around the company and made everything and put this whole track together. And the AFI loved the film and took David as a fellow, and they hired me as their staff sound person. And so that got David and I both out to the West Coast. That's how we both got out to Los Angeles.
Let's talk about your film Eraserhead, mm-hmm. which is a cult classic now. The movie's like a bad dream about urban life where everything is rancid. It's right. a real bleak right. movie. Now, you created a psychological sound environment for that, and in the background, there's this constant, vaguely industrial sound. Let's play a little bit of it.
Okay.
Remind ourselves of how it sounded. What was the psychological effect you were trying to achieve with the background sound?
Essentially, it's just a sort of surreal urban environment that's always, like, pervasive and omnipresent, in a sense.
The sounds in it don't sound exactly like anything I've ever heard before, but it sounds industrial to me. Did you take familiar sounds and make them into this unfamiliar pattern?
We had an old gas heater in the editing room where I was working. It was just which had a big metal case on it. So one day we stuck a microphone down in the bottom of it, a little tiny microphone in the bottom of this thing, and David was blowing into the top of it, and we just got a lot of really strange sounds that way. And another time we floated an old water cooler bottle. Remember the big 5-gallon bottles when they used to be glass? Now they're plastic. We floated that in a bathtub and stuck a microphone inside that and got a really ethereal type of bubbly sound. So we basically made all the sounds ourselves, but they all had organic roots. They weren't, nothing was created electronically. And I think that's one reason why it has the presence that it does, because they are real sounds, even though they've been changed.
I want to take you to another movie that you did with David Lynch, Blue Velvet.
Yes.
There's a scene in Blue Velvet where the hero, who's from a small town, has become involved with a woman who represents all his darkest sexual fantasies. And they're making love, and she says to him, "Hurt me, hit me." And she said that before, and he's refused to do it. But now he does it. He hits her. He hits her
yeah.
hard. Let's play that and hear how it sounds.
Okay.
Hit me!
No! No!
Get away! Get away from that bed! Get away!
That's certainly a smack that reverberates. How did you get it? Was that just a regular slap across somebody's face?
No, we tried that. One of the fellas, my assistant, is a pretty strapping guy, and we tried slapping him on the back. We tried all sorts of stuff like that, and that didn't work. But we were over at a friend's house one day doing some recording, some just odd sound effects, and he happened to have a pumpkin on the floor. So... it was just one of those sort of lucky accidents. We took the pumpkin and we started, first we hit it with our hands, and then we found a metal ruler on his desk, and we started slapping it with a metal ruler.
Now, what would have been wrong with just a regular slap? It's not convincing enough?
It's interesting that when you hear it with your ear, of course it sounds convincing, but when you record it with the microphone, it just loses. It just, there's something lost there. It doesn't have, I don't know, it's hard to describe. Just psychologically, it doesn't convey enough energy. I can't quite tell you why. It's just funny. We all thought that a slapping someone hard on the back, for instance, would do it. But it just didn't have enough starch.
When you started working... on movies with David Lynch, you were using all real sounds. You didn't use synthesizers at all. Now that there's so many synthesizers that are available and computer-generated sounds, do you like to use any of that, or do you still stick with real sound?
I don't like sounds that are artificially created, electronically created. That others can do that. I'm not interested in that at all. There are synthesizers now, though, that will sample real sounds, and you can then process them in the synthesizer as if you were doing electronic sounds, and I've thought about getting one of those synthesizers, but I haven't bothered with it yet. I've not needed it.
There's a lot of sounds that exist in your average house or apartment. And I'm thinking, you know, when I'm at home, the refrigerator's humming. If it's winter, then the radiator pipes are banging.
Yeah.
And there's always an appliance that seems to have a 60-cycle hum to it.
Yeah.
And then maybe one of the faucets is dripping. Do you hear all those sounds a lot? Are you very conscious of them in the course
of
the day?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Something clicks in your head, you know, if a sound is happening and it's interesting, it somehow or other just penetrates the consciousness. It's not like you go to a place and you say, well, I'm going to listen to all the sounds there. It's not a conscious thing. And if it is like an interesting toilet flush, or in the case of some good friends of ours, they had a really interesting pipe knock when they turned their water off. They made this really weird groaning sound. It's just something that you suddenly hear. It just pops into your head and you say, my God, that's a great sound. I got to go record that.
Are there any sounds that drive you crazy?
Yeah, well, for me, it's the, generally the just urban noise. I don't like urban noise. I much prefer woods and, you know, fields and streams and quiet country atmosphere.
This is the man speaking who did the sound for Eraserhead.
Yeah, that doesn't mean I can't create urban environments, but I don't like them. I mean, I can create them on film, but I don't like to be in them.
What movie are you working on now?
Well, it's a film called The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and it's based on a book by Milan Kundera, a Czech author.
What are the sound challenges you're working on with this movie?
I'm actually working more in the music area of it than I am the sound effects, though I will be doing the sound effects on the film, too. This is really exciting to me because it's the first time since my industrial film days that I've been involved in music, and it's really a whole new challenge. I'm not a composer. I don't compose music, but what we've been trying to do is to essentially score the entire film with the music of Leos Janáček, who was a Czech composer whose music probably most closely resembles the feeling textures of the book. That's about the only way I can describe it.
Okay. Alan Splett, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Sound designer Alan Splett spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco. The film The Unbearable Lightness of Being is due out early next year. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program and is joining us from Washington. Happy holiday, Robert.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
What story are you following?
Well, we'll have a report from Neil Conan, who's in the Persian Gulf, about a near incident there, something that could have been like the shooting of the USS Stark, we're told. Also, an update on the prison takeovers in Atlanta and Louisiana. And we'll hear from a 12-year-old Russian girl that was in this country recently who writes poetry and reads it. You've got to hear her readings.
Any Thanksgiving stories?
Yes, indeed. We have a story about a campaign to replace turkey with another dish as the traditional meal, and the most interesting dinner guest we found for Thanksgiving today.
You're going to tell who?
King Olaf of Norway is visiting with a family in Minnesota.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Screenwriter Hanif Qureshi and film director Stephen Frears collaborated on the 1985 surprise hit My Beautiful Laundrette. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of their new film, which, like Laundrette, is about class conflicts and the clashing of cultures in England. The film's title has caused some controversy. The movie is called Sammy and Rosie Get Laid.
The title is like a taunt, a way of saying up yours to the world's blue noses and stuffed shirts, and also to American newspapers, many of which have refused to print the last two words of it. The title smirks at us, and so does the movie, which is energetic and naughty and exciting and very full of itself. In fact, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid is such a colorful phantasmagoria that you may feel it's unseemly, or just too unhip, to stop and ask what screenwriter Hanif Qureshi and director Stephen Frears are actually trying to say. The script is hyper-literate, a din of Tony epigrams and show-offy jokes, all set against a background of 80s London, where the race riots are friendly and cheerful, and the cocktail parties teem with malice.
Rosie, I've missed you.
You don't know me.
If I knew you, it would have been worse.
I do Gestalt therapy, an hour of Indian yoga followed by Buddhist chanting. Do you chant?
Chant what, my dear?
Mantras, to calm yourself.
I am calm. It's agitation, I see. You young international people mystify me. For you, the world and culture is a departmental store. You come in and take something you like from every floor, and you have no attachment, so your life is incoherent and shallow.
I'm a free spirit, open to everything.
The gentleman you just heard talking is Rafi, a renowned Pakistani politician who has fled his country with a fortune, and now he hopes to settle down in the clubby, comforting London he remembers from decades ago. Instead, he finds an urban war zone. Rafi is the father of Sammy, a coke-snorting accountant who lives with his social worker wife, Rosie, in the heart of the riot-torn Brixton ghetto. They're a couple of middle-class kids who've chosen the inner city because they think that's where the action is. According to Sammy, that's where Leonardo da Vinci would have lived had he been dropped, by some cruel fate, into Mrs. Thatcher's London. Sammy and Rosie have a defiantly open marriage, but it's clear that Rosie likes the openness better than Sammy does, and the movie tries to connect the quiet disturbance going on in their sexual relationship with the noisier disturbance going on in the streets. But the filmmakers are also trying to connect a lot of other things that just won't hook up. They want to compare the oppression Rafi practiced on his enemies in Pakistan with the oppression the Thatcher government practices on England's underclass, and all that with various forms of sexual and racial and capitalist oppression. Furthermore, the filmmakers seem to be recommending a program of looting and burning and rock and roll. The movie disingenuously pretends that these mobs destroying their own neighborhoods are basically just having a swell time. Even so, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid might have worked if we could see the connections in the characters and the things they do. But Sammy, as played by Ayub Khan Din, is a cipher. And Rosie, as played by the magnetic Francis Barber, is supposed to be some sort of heroic free spirit, and yet comes across as monstrously willful and cruel. The most delicious performance, and the most problematical, comes from the great Indian actor Shashi Kapoor as Rafi. It's a loving, hammy, juicy portrayal, and in a way, it backfires. Rafi represents everything the filmmakers despise, and yet he's by far the most likable and sympathetic character. Taken bit by bit, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid is a lot of fun, but the parts never cohere. And in the end, all the glue that Qureshi and Frears can provide is a kind of hipper-than-thou smugness. The movie's like a grinning, finger-popping demagogue. If you don't admire me, it smirks, then up yours.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with poet Mark Halliday. His poetry is inspired by what he calls small acts of art, like the yearning in the voice of the Elegance lead singer on the rock and roll ballad Little Star. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss the comedy of Harry Shearer. He's best known for his work on Saturday Night Live and for his role in the heavy metal spoof This Is Spinal Tap. And accordionist William Schimmel will play a few tangos. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller, who is sitting in for our director, Chris Spurgeon. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and happy holiday. is NPR, National Public Radio.